Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Hello, welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today I am speaking to Dr. Kirsten Small, who is a retired obstetrician and gynecologist. She's an educator, researcher, and writer, and her research focuses on central fetal monitoring and fetal heart rate monitoring in labor. She posts on an extremely informative blog, birthsmalltalk.com. And I'm so excited to have you here today to talk about fetal monitoring. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to join you. I always love having an opportunity to let the more of the world know what they need to know in conversations around fetal monitoring in labour.
Yeah. And it's something that's so widely used, isn't it?
It is, and it's so taken for granted that we don't even have good numbers on how often it's used. You know, people don't think to gather that as data even, because it's like the colour of the carpet, you know, it's just there and nobody even notices it anymore, which makes it quite tricky as a researcher to find out, you know, how often it's used in various different parts of the world, because people just aren't collecting that information anymore.
Yeah, It's interesting. When I first trained to teach antenatal classes and, you know, learned about all the different interventions in labour, fetal monitoring was something which I just thought was just, you know, part of the course. It's something that everybody has as standard when they're in labour, and didn't realise some of the research behind it and the fact that, you know, it isn't an evidence-based practice. But we'll get into that in a minute. Let's start right, before I get ahead of myself, let's start right at the basics, because people that are listening might not know what fetal monitoring is. So do you want to explain a little bit about fetal monitoring and the different types that might be offered in labour first off?
Briefly, the history starts with the invention of the stethoscope, and when people realized that you could hear people's hearts from the outside of their body, they invented things that made it easier for them to hear them. And of course, curious folks then went and popped one on the belly of a pregnant woman and went, oh, there's something in there that sounds like a heart rate, but it's faster than the woman's, what's that? And realized they could hear the fetal heart. And this idea that you could tell whether a fetus was healthy or not came along quite early. So by about 1830s, we see people starting to use what was available at the time, Pinard stethoscopes, to listen to the fetal heart during labour to try and work out whether this is a baby that's healthy or not. Because they didn't have easy recourse to things like cesarean section at that time. So mostly it was about waiting until the baby was dead so that you could do fairly awful things to it to be able to end the woman's labour. And that's morphed over time, obviously, as cesarean sections become a more common and safer procedure for women, into, you know, how can we tell that this is a baby that will benefit from being born now rather than at the end of the natural labour progress. And so, you know, people have kind of had a bit of a guess, really, as to, you know, if the heart rate slows down during the middle of a contraction and then it recovers again by the end of it, well, that's probably okay. If it takes a bit longer to recover, well, that's probably not okay. But, you know, we don't really have good physiology stuff, and most of it was done in the 1950s and the 1960s, and it's only been in recent years that people have started looking at that again to go, do we really know what we're doing with this? But, you know, so we've ended up with this really deep-seated belief that listening to the baby's heart rate in labour is an essential thing that gives us useful information. And then because, you know, people couldn't spend their entire life listening physically to the heart rate, equipment got invented that did the job so that you could continuously monitor the fetal heart rate. And attached to that, you also then monitor what's going on with the woman's uterine contractions, and you plot the two of those together on a graph, and that becomes the thing that's called the cardio for heart, toco is the word for contractions, graph, so CTG or cardiotocograph. Lots of people call it fetal monitoring, electronic fetal monitoring, EFM. I don't like that terminology because I think it puts us in a difficult position when we're communicating with people, because listening to the baby using something, a stethoscope, a handheld Doppler on an intermittent basis, that's also fetal monitoring. And if you're using a Doppler, it's also electronic.
Yeah.
Fetal monitoring. And so the whole idea of what's electronic fetal monitoring and what isn't gets a bit fuzzy. So I prefer to talk about CTGs and intermittent auscultation. The other problem with calling it fetal monitoring is that then if you're not using continuous CTG monitoring in labor, people say, oh, she's not being monitored, which is nonsense, because we've got this other approach to fetal monitoring, but it becomes non-monitoring, and it, you know, it's very easy then to give people the impression that we're taking flagrant risks with the life of their baby because we're not monitoring the baby, which is nonsense.
Yeah, it's what the terminology
I think is important in terms of not falling into little holes in our thought processes that lead people to end up believing things that aren't really true.
Yeah. And most people will have experienced like handheld Dopplers and intermittent monitoring, you know, at antenatal appointments and things. CTG monitoring is those kind of monitors that get strapped onto your belly, aren't they? So they monitor the baby's heart rate, they monitor the contractions. And I know in the UK, CTG monitoring is recommended if you've had an epidural or you've been induced with synthetic oxytocin. If there are any kind of concerns or complications with baby, and concerns of baby's heart rate, are there circumstances where CTG may be used, which you know, using a Doppler or intermittent monitoring actually is a good or sufficient alternative?
We have a very widely held myth that even most midwives and obstetricians don't realize is not based in evidence. The first part of it is that if you are a woman who doesn't have risk factors, then intermittent auscultation is preferable to CTG monitoring because it is as safe for the baby without increasing the cesarean section rate, which CTG use does. So that's part one of the myth. Part two of the myth is that if you have a risk factor, and as you said, if there's some intervention like an epidural or an induction of labour, then the evidence shows that if you have CTG monitoring, then the outcome is far better. That's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
If you pile all of the research into one great big lump, we know that whether you use intermittent auscultation with something like a Doppler device or a CTG machine continuously through labor, the rate of stillbirth or death of the baby in the first week after birth is the same. We don't save babies' lives by doing CTG monitoring. There's no difference in the number of babies that end up in the nursery with issues. There's no difference in babies born with low Apgar scores or with levels of acid in their blood. The only thing that changes is the rate of neonatal seizures, but you need to monitor about 660 women to prevent one baby from developing a seizure. So it's, you know, it's an uncommon problem in the first place, and it's not a particularly effective way of preventing that from happening. Now, here's the thing. When you start splitting that up according to women who are considered to be low risk and women who are considered to be high risk, the reduction in neonatal seizures only reaches statistical significance in the low risk population. It doesn't actually change for women who are at high risk.
Wow.
So this idea that if you've got risk factors, you really don't have a choice. You have to have a CTG because something terrible is going to happen to you if you don't. You cannot back that up with research. There just isn't the research to show that that's true. Partly because we've got research that shows that it doesn't work, but it, to a large extent, we've got not really, you know, not the research that we need to be able to answer those questions. And occasionally there's been some research that should have flagged us as being, oh, you know, we need to be really careful here. There might be something dangerous going on that we really need to look into. But instead of digging a bit deeper, collectively, obstetricians around the world kind of went, la, 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 I'll just pretend this isn't happening because I don't like this story very much. Yeah. So in the mid-1980s, there was a study that showed that if you use CTG monitoring specifically in preterm labour, then the chance that that baby will end up developing cerebral palsy was 2.5 times higher when women had CTG monitoring than they had intermittent auscultation. Small study, there was only 173 women. It was the mid-1980s. We've changed how we look after women in preterm labour and how babies, preterm babies are looked after in the nursery. So who knows what that means for now. But in the 40 years since then, no one's thought to go, you know what, we should probably do that study again.
Yeah.
You know, people just wander around pretending that it didn't happen, it isn't worth investigating further, CTG monitoring clearly works, we should just keep doing it. The one thing that comes really clearly out of the research, regardless of whether you're talking about women at low risk or women at high risk, is that it increases the use of cesarean section and forceps and vacuums and decreases the possibility that you're going to have a spontaneous vaginal birth without some kind of assistance, which, you know, in some respects, you know, one way of having a baby, another way of having a baby is a really big deal. Well, it is if, A, that wasn't what you wanted to happen in the first place. Your intention in starting labour was actually to have a vaginal birth. And, there are more risks and complications both for mother and babies in the short term from those procedures and in the long term as well. You know, pelvic floor damage is more common with vacuum and forceps birth. Stillbirth is more common in the next pregnancy after a woman's had a cesarean section, and as is preterm birth. Mm-hmm. So the things that we do in the first pregnancy that result in cesarean section, forceps or vacuum can have an impact on the health of that woman throughout the rest of her life and the chances of having a healthy pregnancy the next time around. So, you know, it's more than just, oh, well, you know, a cesarean section ended up being the better option for me on the day.
Yeah.
And I think one of the challenges for women giving birth is that you have no way of knowing if you have CTG monitoring and there's a problem with the heart rate and someone says, oh, quick, we've got to go and do a cesarean section. There is no way that you or your care provider can know whether that cesarean section was actually necessary and would have made a difference to the outcome of that baby. But as a care provider, it is so much easier for yourself and for the family to convince them that this was the right idea. So one of the really common things that I hear is, oh, but my baby would have died if I didn't have CTG monitoring. And, you know, maybe that was true for that particular person, but it isn't borne out by research that we're doing anything that's useful for people. One of the things I get asked a lot is, oh, but what about, you know, insert X here, what about women being induced? What about women over the age of 40? What about twins? What about diabetes? What about previous cesarean section? We just don't know. As I said, most of our problem with the research around women with risk factors is that we haven't done it. So most of the studies that have looked at risk have kind of just piled everybody in and pressed the button on the blender so that you can't tell, is there a particular subset of women where CTG monitoring is actually beneficial, where we should be doing it or not? We don't know. My own, as somebody who's recently been in clinical practice, my own gut feeling is that it is probably when we're using oxytocin in labour for either induction of labour or to speed up a labour that's been slowed. It's actually, it's a fairly dangerous hormone to use, and it's fairly easy to go from a really nice normal contraction pattern to too many contractions, and it overcomes any of the natural feedback loops that baby might have to go, whoa, whoa, too many contractions, you need to back off, slow down, because, you know, if we're not getting four contractions every 10 minutes, because that's what it says in the guideline, even if this is a baby that can only handle two, that baby can't take control anymore because someone's flicking the drip rate up on a regular basis. And I think that's when, more so because of what's going on the bottom line of the CTG with the contraction pattern, but also to then be able to keep really close track of how the baby's responding to it. But as I said, that's, you know, that's based on a fairly fine reading of some of the hidden bits of the research, not because there's a great research trial that shows that when women are on oxytocin that the outcomes are so much better for them with if they have CTG monitoring.
Yeah. So why are we using it so widely? If it's not evidence-based and the research doesn't back it, why do you think we in air quotes, you know, the hospitals and the doctors kind of cling to the use of CTG so hard?
That question was the driver for me doing my PhD. Like, why on earth are we still doing this nonsense? You know, we have not done a new randomized controlled trial about CTG monitoring since 2006. We knew by the mid 1980s when some of the big trials were done that it quite clearly wasn't working for us. But what had already happened by that stage was that everyone had started using it in clinical practice on the background of some pretty awful research that was done when it was first introduced, where people just went, okay, so we're going to start using CTG monitoring at our hospital. So for the 2 years before we started it, we're going to look at how many babies were born and how they did. And then for the 2 years after we start using it, we're going to look at how the babies did. And a lot of this stuff's happening in the early 1970s when, you know, we invented neonatal intensive care units for the first time and started ventilating babies that were really in a really poor condition. So there's been huge advances in neonatal care, which obstetricians have kind of said was our fault because, you know, it was our CTG monitoring that made all the difference. It's probably actually what was happening after the baby was born that was resulting in these kids growing up in a much better state than they were before, not the CTG monitoring. And there was also some legal reform processes happening at the same time, particularly in the USA, where it made it much easier to be able to sue doctors. And because there'd been this promise that if you use CTG monitoring, nothing bad will ever happen, when something bad did happen and CTG monitoring had not been used, or there'd been a suggestion that had been not used appropriately, it became very easy to win large sums of money off your doctor. You know, people just got very frightened that if they weren't doing it, that they were going to get sued. And that still is a strong driver, is fear of litigation or fear of just somehow getting in trouble because it's against the rules and you'll end up losing your job or getting deregistered as a professional or investigated because, you know, you're not doing what the guidelines say you should be doing.
It is interesting because it is such standard practice and it is so heavily embedded in care. That when somebody does say that they don't want continual monitoring, everybody freaks out. They're like, you know, it makes the midwives and it makes the doctors feel very, very nervous. And I think one thing that's not considered in all of this is the maternal satisfaction of the person with the CTG monitor on, you know, because yes, the research that you've mentioned shows that it doesn't potentially, you know, improve outcomes. It does increase the risk of C-section, but it's also extremely uncomfortable for somebody who's in labor to be stuck on their back with the CTG monitor on, particularly if that's not the position they wanted to be in or that's not where they wanted to be. And I don't think there's loads of research looking at, you know, people's experiences of using CTG monitoring as well.
There isn't, and most of it was done during the 1980s and we stopped doing it, and despite the fact that the technology's been progressively developed over time and changed. The other reason, and this is the one that keeps me being so passionate about this, and why I continue to want to talk to groups of people anytime I get the chance to, is one of the key pillars in maternity care, whether you're a midwife, an obstetrician, an obstetric nurse, you know, anyone who works in maternity care, it's about informed choice and being woman-centered, and the idea that it's not my decision as the care provider to make, it's yours. It's my job to give you honest, accurate, and non-biased information that doesn't push you in one direction or the other. It's your job to make a decision. And that doesn't happen as a routine when it comes to choices around fetal heart rate monitoring in labor. We end up with this real black and white approach that, oh, you're low risk. I'm not even going to mention CTG monitoring. You will get intermittent auscultation. And it's best that I don't open that particular can of worms with you because it'll just make more work for me. So let's just go with that. If you have any kind of a risk factor, then most women are not, they don't have a conversation that looks like an informed choice conversation. They're told, oh, because you have X, you have to have, I'm just going to pop this on now. This is just what the routine is, you know. And the idea that you can actually opt out of that is not brought up with women. And so it's only the occasional woman who has, you know, done her own research, talked to people, read stuff, who goes in armed with knowledge and gets a bit strong and upright about it, that has any chance of being involved in decision-making around that, which is just, it's so at odds with all of what we teach about the way that we should be practicing maternity care. And there's been some good research, and there continues to be good research. I've just posted some recently, or it might be coming out this week, actually, about studies that look at how often women are actually invited to participate in decision making when it comes to fetal heart rate monitoring in labor. And some of the studies show that you've got less than 10% of women saying that they gave an informed choice about the approach to fetal monitoring that was being used. And in other studies, women being, you know, they're basically ignored and told, no, you must have, you don't have a choice. And that, you know, as a feminist, that gets me kind of riled up, that, you know, that we're so dishonest about what the research shows with people. And we're dishonest, it's not so much that we as health professionals know and we're keeping it a secret. We're dishonest within the professions as well, about what the evidence says. And, you know, as a junior doctor learning obstetrics as a craft, I was also taught, oh, look, it doesn't work for low-risk women, but for high-risk women it absolutely does. Mm-hmm. And it was only that when I reached a point in my life where I was starting to hear more from women about they don't want some of the things that mainstream obstetrics has to offer, that I had a woman's partner, she was pregnant with twins, and her partner said, well, we don't want CTG monitoring. You're going to have to produce some evidence to show that it works. And I thought, hold my beer, this will be easy, and went and had a look, and I couldn't find any. Yeah. It doesn't exist. There is none. And had to come back at the next consult and go, I'm sorry, but you're right. There actually isn't any evidence to show that monitoring your labour is with a CTG is going to improve outcomes on the basis that this is a twin pregnancy. Which was, you know, part of the lead into the PhD then, was to go and read more and read more and realise that the stuff that I'd been taught as an obstetrician was incorrect. And, you know, our guidelines keep repeating the same nonsense. NICE in the UK is slightly better, I have to say, of all of the guidelines. They at least acknowledge that the research is not quite as sound as it should be, but in many other parts of the world, particularly here in Australia, our guidelines are very clear that if you have any whiff of a risk factor, then you shall have CTG monitoring and you will not be really given a choice about it. And if as a clinician you don't then fall in line with that and you actually support women to make an informed choice, then watch out, because somebody will be coming for you.
So, well, how do you think the Ockenden report is going to affect things then? Where does that decision come from? Because what the Ockenden report is a report that's come out in the UK after a lot of very unfortunate outcomes at a hospital in the UK, and they started digging and compiling evidence, and that has influenced this report, which has made lots of suggestions and to improve the outcomes of mothers and babies. And one of those suggestions is to have central fetal monitoring, isn't it, in the hospitals. Do you want to explain a little bit about what central fetal monitoring is and what impact that could potentially have?
Yeah, so as technology for CTG monitoring has, as I said, has changed over the years. And originally it was just, you know, it printed to a piece of paper on a machine at the bedside in an analog way. And then that'd end up in your chart, or it'd get lost, or somebody had spilled their coffee on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So once we got a bit more technologically capable, then we collected that information as digital data, so that you could then display it on a computer screen and record it as digital data, so that it went into people's electronic health records, so that it could never, you know, accidentally get lost or have cups of tea spilled over the top of it, which is handy. And I don't have a problem with digitally collecting that information so that it's there as a permanent record. Alongside that, because it's digital, you can move that data anywhere you have an internet connection. Mm-hmm. So central fetal monitoring takes the data from the individual woman in her birth room and adds it to all of the other individual women in all of their birth rooms within a birthing facility and displays it in a room that's central for the staff within the service, so hence central fetal monitoring. So there'll be a room somewhere where there's a bank of screens and you can see the CTG from every woman who has a CTG on at that particular point in time in that facility. And the idea is that that makes it safer, because if the midwife's wandered off out of the room to go to the loo, then somebody else can be watching the CTG from outside. If the midwife's not very clever and can't realise that there's a problem, then somebody who's outside hopefully is more clever and realises and goes in. And it all sounds very straightforward. And so people believe that there must be, again, good evidence behind this, because why would you spend sometimes millions of dollars on these very expensive, flash-looking, high-tech systems if they didn't work, right? So their existence kind of becomes proof of the fact that they must work, because they, like, why would they be there if they didn't? Mm-hmm. In fact, there's never been a randomized control trial to show that central fetal monitoring is better than the standard approach. There's only been three studies where people had a central fetal monitoring system in use and it broke. And so they then had a time period where there was no central monitoring system, and they had to go back to the old fashioned approach of actually going into the room if you wanted to see what was on the CTG. And so they compared what happened to outcomes before and after. Absolutely no difference in outcomes for the babies, whether there was central fetal monitoring or not. But when you turned the central monitoring off, the cesarean section rate fell. So using central monitoring pushes the Caesar rate up above what we're already seeing it pushed up, because it's CTG monitoring in the first place.
Wow. Even more than using CTG normally.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. With no, again, you know, no apparent benefit for the baby, but the mum's paying the price in terms of having a higher chance of being told she'll need a cesarean section. That's as far as we've got really in terms of assessing safety of it. My doctoral research, I did an ethnography, so I was interested in culture and what was happening in an organisation where they had introduced a central fetal monitoring 2 years previously. So I didn't go in specifically to go, well, is this safe or not? But the stuff that I saw made me deeply concerned about the fact that there's certainly risk of some harm happening and some trade-offs, so that, you know, maybe it's safer for the baby, but there's a whole pile of other stuff that isn't happening because it's not on the CTG. So, you know, when it got busy, it was easy for the senior staff, for the, you know, the obstetric team and for the midwife in charge of the shift, instead of rounding and going into each room to see what was actually going on. They just stand in front of the bank of the CTGs and go, that one's okay, that one's okay, that one's okay, I better go into room 8 because that one's not. And so they're not walking into the room where the CTG is normal, but the woman's bleeding or she's got a high temperature or, you know, there's something else going on that they're just not going to notice because the CTG is okay. Mm. And I had midwives say that on a busy shift, it was really hard to get people to see the wood for the trees. So, you know, if you've got 13 CTGs running and two of them are really, really abnormal, then your baby, who's actually a growth-restricted 36-weeker that's being induced because they're really concerned about, who's got just the slightest change on the CTG, which is actually hugely significant for that baby in that context, would get ignored because these other robust term healthy babies would have these spectacularly abnormal looking CTGs and they were getting all the attention instead in a way that wouldn't necessarily happen if people walked into the birth room and went, oh, that's right, you're the woman with the little baby that we're inducing because we're worried about it not being healthy. Mm-hmm. So I've published on that, and it's fairly recent stuff. So, you know, we're still waiting to see what the world makes of it. But yeah, when I saw the Ockenden recommendation that every maternity unit should have central fetal monitoring, it raises significant concerns for me. We, you know, in the absence of research showing that that's safe, we shouldn't be doing that. We should instead be funding research to know whether it is safe or not.
Yeah. Oh, it's concerning, isn't it? I did see one study, I don't think it was a very large study, that looked at central monitoring. and they found that the women who gave birth in rooms of central monitoring, it elevated their stress levels compared to people who didn't have central monitoring because they were left on their own. And there was no midwife in the room, and that really elevated stress levels. And again, it's thinking about that experience, isn't it, of the person giving birth and using all these tools and how that affects their experiences.
Part of that depends on the culture of the organisation. So where I was doing my data collection had a very strong one midwife, one woman, and you stay in the room the whole time. And so there wasn't a lot of people being left on their own while staff were out having snacks at the central monitoring desk. Yeah. But I certainly have heard stories from other places where, particularly on night shifts, where it becomes quite common for them to have a big tea party and everybody's sitting out just watching the monitoring screens rather than being in rooms. But what I did see and what most of my research ended up being about was this phenomenon that the midwives at this particular hospital called being K2'd, which was the name of their central monitoring system, which was when the midwife was busy doing things that midwives do in a room with a woman, and there was a perception on the part of the people outside the room at the central monitoring station that the CTG was either abnormal or couldn't be interpreted and needed to be done about the CTG. Now, most of the time, the midwife had also recognised that and was busy doing the things that the midwife needed to do to be able to address the fact that there was a problem with the CTG. So, you know, they were getting the woman onto the bed, they were doing the vaginal examination, they were changing positions, they were readjusting equipment, they were rupturing membranes and putting scalp electrodes on. But because they were doing that, they weren't then at the computer pressing the buttons to say that they were doing the things. Mm-hmm. So outside the room, it looked like nothing was going on. So So they've then got this woman who's naked on the bed in the midst of having a vaginal examination when suddenly, kabam, the doors slam open and six people walk into the room because they're worried about the CTG. The woman doesn't know it's about to happen. Suddenly, you know, she's there with her bits all exposed to the world, and there's a bunch of strangers in her room talking over the top of her midwife going, we don't like this, you know, this baby's in distress. And it raised a huge amount of anxiety for the midwives. Mm. I didn't interview women. That wasn't part of what I set out to do originally with the research, but the midwives certainly told me about their impression that it generated high levels of anxiety in the women. And once they kind of talked everybody down from that high level of anxiety, you know, it's fine, the heart rate's okay, she was just vomiting, and so there was a bit of time where we weren't picking up the heart rate, and we've got it now and everything's all right and you can go, and you know, for the rest of the labor, both the midwife and the woman would kind of be on this heightened anxiety, you know, every time there was a noise in the corridor, thinking that they were suddenly going to be bombarded all over again. And as I said, a bit like CTG monitoring has become like the carpet on the floor that no one notices anymore, central monitoring very much is like that. And women are not told that if you give birth at hospital A, there is a central fetal monitoring system, and you may have that kind of an experience as part of your labour. If you go to hospital B, they don't have that.
Wow. That's a really good point, actually. That's something that I wouldn't have even considered.
Yeah, and you can't opt out of it. If you're in a hospital that has a central fetal monitoring system, you're in a hospital that has a central fetal monitoring system.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of mind-blowing. You mentioned fetal scalp electrode.
Mm.
It's something that that I post about on my Instagram periodically, because I think lots of parents don't know what it is, or they've had it in labor and not realized what it is because it was kind of misrepresented or kind of minimized as a form of monitoring. So do you want to speak a little bit about what fetal scalp electrode is?
Yeah. And people get told things like, oh, we're just going to pop a clip on, and, you know, kind of get told the specifics of that. Mm-hmm. Particularly in bigger women, or when there's a lot of amniotic fluid around the outside of the baby, or when the baby's in a posterior position, you know, it's a long way from the outside to the baby's heart to be able to hear it clearly from the outside. So it can be difficult to reliably pick up the heart rate all of the time. If the woman's changing positions a lot because she's really mobile, or she's in the shower and the shower water's hitting the heart rate monitor, you might not get a recording. And the point of CTG is to have a continuous recording of the heart rate all of the time. So people want to do something about fixing that. So one option is to then use an electrode that physically attaches to the baby so that you're recording the electrical impulse that their heart generates. It also records the mother and then does some fancy calculations to cancel one out against the other so that all you're picking up is the heart rate from the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little wire that physically screws through the surface of the baby's scalp so that you've got the wire is actually embedded in the tissues and surrounded by the, you know, the juices that are inside the cells of our bodies to use as a conducting agent to transfer the electrical signal. So it has to breach the surface of the baby's skin. You have to have ruptured the woman's membranes to be able to place it. And, you know, obviously it requires a vaginal examination to get it into place. And that, you know, how easy it is for that to happen depends a lot on how dilated the cervix is at the time. If somebody's 8 or 9 centimetres and the head's well down, that can be really easy and quick to put on. If you're 1 centimetre dilated and the head's really high and you're just starting an induction and somebody's trying to put it on, it can be really fiddly and really uncomfortable for women to have it placed.
Mm-hmm.
They can cause trauma to the scalp. There are case reports of things like brain abscesses and skin infections that can be quite significant. Fortunately, they are rare. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they can be avoided completely by not using them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's one of these areas where we should be inviting women to have a conversation and saying, this is a choice. And these are the pros and cons of this. What would you like to do? And instead, often, not always, but often being strong-armed into it. You know, we need to see what your baby's doing. Otherwise, it'll die. So I just have to pop this clip on the surface of your baby's head without actually really talking about what's involved and the fact that there are some risks associated with it.
Is there any research or is there any evidence to show or disprove that the efficiency or the effectiveness of using a fetal scalp electrode similarly to CTG monitoring?
There's research that looks at what proportion of time on the trace you can actually record the fetal heart rate, and it is better if you're using a scalp electrode than if you're using an external heart rate monitor. What we don't have is research about whether that translates into better outcomes for the baby.
Okay.
Again, and it's more a case of we don't know because no one's actually done the research, rather than we've done the research and it shows no difference.
Yeah.
There are so many, you know, people so strongly believe what they're doing works because they want it to work. Like, we all want it to work. Nobody wants a baby to die during labor. It is so, so awful. Nobody wants a baby born having seizures who then develops a long-term disability and needs additional care. So the mere whiff of a promise that we've got a technology that might prevent that from happening is enough to get us all using it without actually scratching the surface and asking the hard questions as to whether it actually lives up to expectations or not.
Mm. Yeah, I think, again, it just shows, I say this all the time, but it just shows why it's so important that parents do their own research, because, you know, the middle of labor probably isn't the best time to be gathering that information to be able to make that informed decision, is it? I mean, really, we need to be doing the research.
It's a conversation that needs to be happened during pregnancy. Where we are at this particular point in maternity services with CTG use, I do think there is value in women educating themselves and going in armed with, you know, this is what I intend to do, rather than please can I, will you let me. Be careful with the language that you use. But it shouldn't be that way. You know, women should not need a master's degree in childbirth to be able to get good care. Because it tends to favour educated, wealthy women who have connections, who can access that information. And somebody who's a migrant, who's, living on the streets, who's a drug user, you know, there's no way that they're going to be able to find out that information and advocate for themselves. What we need is systems that make it really difficult for care providers to not give women a choice, to not give women the information that they need to be able to make the decisions that they need to make for good care. And at the moment, we've kind of got this perverse incentive where we've got the opposite of that, where people will probably get into trouble and they don't have the time to do it anyway. So it's just easier to kind of go along with the organisational flow and just pop the CTG on and let's be done with it.
Yeah, it is an organisational issue, change, isn't it? And I guess when we've got student midwives who are being taught this stuff from the get-go, you know, that the CTG monitoring is necessary and this is routine and this is procedure, why would they question it, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We need to change the conversation within the professions so that we are being honest with ourselves, because until that happens, we can't start having honest conversations with the women that we're serving. And we need guideline change. That level of reform to be able to turn that around is hugely time consuming, and we need people to save some energy for that kind of work. And if we just exhaust ourselves at the front line, then there is no energy left to be able to do that kind of work. And particularly, you know, for me outside the UK, looking in and seeing the huge concerns that are coming up about staffing issues, you know, your midwives are struggling to get time for a cup of tea and a pee, let alone to engage with research and have conversations with policy writers about changing policy. So, you know, if you want to keep a system bogged down in the same ways of doing things that we've always done, you run it short-staffed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a political choice that's been made in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. You're entirely right. Yeah. Okay, so if people do want to do their own research, I always direct them to your blog, because there is a wealth of evidence and research and information there. Are there any particular studies that you would recommend people go and have a look at or read?
I've done a systematic literature review about the intermittent auscultation versus CTG specifically in a high risk population, and you'll find some posts about it on Birth Small Talk. In most places, and certainly in the UK, there's the Cochrane review. So there's three Cochrane reviews about CTG monitoring. One's for monitoring in labour, one's for monitoring during pregnancy, and one's for the admission CTG when people just, you know, they have. It'll only be 20 minutes, you know, and then we'll take it off again. But more often than not, it turns into being stuck on the monitor for the entire duration of labour. Mm-hmm. So that summarises all of the evidence. And there's lots of in-depth researchy, you know, 95% confidence and intervals and stuff that are a bit tricky to read. But there are plain language summaries included in each of those as well that are easy to access for anyone who doesn't necessarily have any healthcare training to be able to have a look at those. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Well, I think your blog is amazing. I'm looking forward to reading the next post when it goes up, because you post very often. But thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Are you on social media? I know you're on Twitter because I follow you on Twitter, but I can't remember.
Yeah, at Birth Small Talk is on Twitter. I've also got a Facebook page. Officially, I have an Insta one as well, but I never ever use it. By the time I've gotten around both of them and writing a blog post, there's just not enough days left in the week to do anything with Insta.
Yeah, no, okay, I completely get that. Keeping on top of all the social media platforms is a nightmare. So,
there is a book coming, and there's an online course coming, both of which will probably be next year at this rate. But yeah, I will be making a loud noise when they're finally ready.
Oh, exciting. I can't look forward to seeing that. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And I'll make sure that I give you a follow.
Thanks, Erin.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.